Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are on paper 41, right at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 455. And we are ready to start the next block of papers, a block of two. These next two papers are the contrast to that, to the previous extensive block that we just finished. We just finished that block on the universes of beings, you know, going through all the different beings that function at the local universe level. And now we have this block on the universes of things. And when you think about the universes of things, you know, and you know, you're basically meaning the local universes when you're saying that universes of things. However, because the physical domain is uniform throughout the seven super universes, you know, every local universe is the same physically, you know, even out into the outer space levels, it's all the same physics. You don't have any of the power beings regulating the physical domain out in the outer space levels like you do in the seven super universes, but you know, the foundational physics is identical. So when you talk about universes of things, it isn't so much like the previous block where you know you're trying to go through the local universe beings that you hadn't gotten to yet as you were coming down from above and going through all of the higher beings in the previous papers. This pair of papers is apropos to the whole picture. All right, now you'll see that in starting out, before it really gets into astronomy and physics, you know, in a more immediate sense that we think of it from a human perspective, it's going to pick up on the details with the power beings that we started to get into back in paper 29. If you recall there, you know, towards the end of the first part of the book. So you'll see, if you recall back then, you'll see some things that are familiar as we start to get into this. And what they give us here allows us to reflect a little bit more on the details because, you know, you aren't taking such a high altitude perspective on it. So let's see how it goes here.
Paper 41. Physical aspects of the local universe. The characteristic space phenomenon which sets off each local creation from all others is the presence of the creative spirit. All Nebadon is certainly pervaded by the space presence of the divine minister of Salvington, and such presence just as certainly terminates at the outer borders of our local universe. That which is pervaded by our local universe Mother Spirit is Nebadon. That which extends beyond her space presence is outside Nebadon, being the extra Nebadon space regions of the super universe of Orvinton, other local universes.
Okay. Now, the basics there is what we have, point to often, but you know, here you have it very, very definitively stated. So there's no wiggle room, and it's crystal clear that when you're talking about a local universe, you're not talking about a fact that is fundamentally defined in terms of its boundaries, its extent, by the extent of just mere physical systems. Be they large systems or small systems, nebulae or just clusters or whatnot. Okay, that's not the fundamental fact. And that's why it's called a universe. When something is called a universe, be it a local universe, a super universe, the central universe, the grand universe, the master universe, whenever they use the term universe, they mean there is a distinct degree of self-contained nature, you know, in the literal sense of the word universe, one turning, you know, in Latin. And a universe is defined by the presence of a given mother. God the Mother at a particular level. The local universe, creative mother spirit, the super universe, reflective mother spirits, etc. Now, but it's fundamentally that ubiquitous presence of that being that, called a she, you know, as personalized deity, God, rather than a he, because it is that being has an extended presence. They're not sort of just localized at some point in space. They're on this world or that world or whatever. They're spread out over a vast region. They're that fundamental expression of place in that duality of place and direction, which we have so immediately recognizable in a local universe. So the Creator Son, the He is the direction, and the Creator Mother Spirit, the She is the place. She establishes the place and maintains the place. So they italicize is there. Our local universe, Mother Spirit, is Nevadon. Her body, you know, literally her spirit energy, mind energy, etc., presence defines it. And like they said, it, she's not only, you know, to those that can perceive that, the substance of that fact, not only is she very definitively just right in front of you, no matter where you are in the local universe of Nevadon, you're immersed in the fact of her presence, and you can see that, but you can just as definitively see where the boundary is. You know, it's a sharp line. Here's the end of her presence, and you step another inch over that boundary, and you're not in her presence anymore. You're in the presence of another creative mother spirit.
Or not.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that in a second.
So if you go from her to another one, how is there extra space involved to put other universes in?
Well, we're going to get to that. I don't want to bring that. We just wait 1 second before we go into that detail, because that's the very last thing in the paragraph. I said that just for ease of the moment. I'll get into the details in a second. Okay, now the other thing to note there is they used three different designations. They started out with just creative spirit. Okay, so reminding you that, you know, before she is a creative mother spirit, before the primary eruption, you have just that downstepped expression of merely the infinite spirit, you know, rather than the infinite mother spirit. You know, and as just a creative spirit, she is working with the power beings. You know, so she's really, and of course, she's really not a she. You know, it's an it at that point. It's a pre-personal in terms of experience and from the finite perspective. You know, and that it presence is working with the power beings on what they're going to mention here in the next paragraph. The precursor stages of getting the physical aspects of the local universe. You know, the title of the paper, established. And then there's the primary eruption, and now she's a creative mother spirit. You've added mother deity to that spirit-type deity, and it definitively has a personal manifestation to higher beings. And she is now going, you know, there's now going to be universe of beings that we just read about, and they're all going to be minded by her. So now it's not just a spirit presence, it's also a mind presence. There's mind energy that's ubiquitous throughout that whole volume. And she's ministering both of them to those beings. You know, the divine minister. She's ministering the spirit and mind ministries. You know, and then, you know, calling her the local universe mother spirit. Or the term that you can also use, a creative mother spirit. Okay, so, you know, they did that just to remind you of the complexity of what's present there and how it had a time history. You know, that very much, for those who, you know, have lived over the last trillion years, you know, they've watched a definitive evolution of that fact and its relationship to the physical aspects of our local universe. You know, and if you, and those for who've lived longer, they've even experienced, you know, what was going on Paradise before, you know, Creator Son and Creator Spirit came out here. You know, so who knows how long before a trillion years ago that was. Okay, now to the thing that John was bringing up. This is a spot where you have a very definitive statement to get you thinking about this issue of, you know, we just generally say, okay, a super universe, you know, has 100,000 local universes, and we don't, you know, think, well, okay, so we got this region, and maybe there's like 100,000 spheres, you know, of space. But, you know, look at what they say here very precisely. They say that if you go beyond her space presence, you're outside Nebadon. You are in the extra Nebadon space regions of the superuniverse of Orvintan. Okay, and that's all kind of what you would just expect. It's in the parenthetical at the very end. Other local universes. Okay, to be in the extra Nebadon space regions of the superuniverse of Orvintan is equivalent to saying is you're in other local universes. So that appears to indicate that you, the creative mother spirits, are juxtaposed, that they're butted up against each other, and you know, this is a complex fact. So they probably have various shapes. That their presence, you know, they're not all circles, you know, or discs or spheres or something simple like that. I mean, obviously, if they're all spheres, there would be big gaps. And, you know, you bring two diameters together and you've got big gaps. You know, you can't fill all of the space with a bunch of marbles, you know, a bunch of spheres. So, I mean, if it means to go out to be in another one, immediately in another one, see, that's, I mean, it isn't, obviously, it isn't super definitive, but it's kind of suggestive that they just say that you're in other local universes if you're outside. Okay, so the reason I'm pressing this a little bit is, do you remember way back when we were reading the Solitary Messenger paper, and we were pondering a little bit about just how far it might be to get to another local universe? You know, and there was a suggestion there that that it was appropriate to say something like hundreds of years traveling at three times the speed of light, you know, rather than just flipping out the phrase thousands, you know, as if, you know, it's going to be several thousands. I mean, they said hundreds, and we were thinking about it, like, well, that's not a lot of years for them to be saying. That's getting to be quite a long time. We better send a solitary messenger first because it's going to take a while, you know, to get there, especially if you're not just thinking the immediate neighboring local universe. You know, hundreds seemed like a kind of a small number. Well, you know, if they're not, you know, if you don't think of them as, you know, in just two dimensions to make it simple, think about it, you know, if you don't think of them as a circular region, you know, where you to get from like center to center, you've got to go, you know, a whole diameter, you know, if they're roughly the same size. You know, if they're various shapes, like states, you know, it appears that they're suggesting we should think like the states of the United States, okay, and that they have various shapes, and they butt up against each other, and, you know, to get from one capital to another, you know, if it happens to be kind of, narrower, the local universes, you know, tend to be narrower along that direction. You know, you may be going more than one local universe and still not be going extremely far. You know, what if they're long shaped, say? You know, like if this is, you know, this circular table is the disk of the Milky Way galaxy, you know, what if they're kind of long shaped, you know, going around the center, you know, rather than really localized, you know, or, you know, we don't know exactly how this is. Plus, if they're stacked vertically, you know, they might not be as thick as they are, you know, long or wide, you know, and so if you're going this, you know, vertically, you know, it might not be as far. So that's, those are the kind of things to think about. Now, the element to bring in about something that you would think would be maybe not in a local universe, that there might be some spaces that are in between local universes. First of all, obviously, when things are not even remotely close to being settled, you might suspect that there would be gaps, okay? But even if things were getting quite far along, you know, let's say, you know, you're in a super universe that has all 100,000 local universes up and rolling, at the very least, you would think that the minor sector, major sector, and the super universe capitals would all be outside of boundaries, you know, of a local universe, that you wouldn't have one of those sets of architectural worlds in a particular local universe. Okay? And so even there, you would expect at least, you know, for a long time in the beginning stages of a super universe, that, you know, that anyone coming from any local universe has to become a first stage spirit, you know, be able to unplug from their creative mother spirit to get to their minor sector capital. You know, that there isn't a special super universe where you don't have to graduate from your local universe to get to the minor sector capital. Okay? Now, once you have a super universe, which probably means the whole grand universe, settled in light and life, that probably goes away. Because remember what we saw when we were studying the details they gave us about peripheral paradise. And they said that there was exactly 7 trillion installations. You know, but we know that they make a point of saying there's only approximately 7 trillion inhabited worlds. You know, and then we were, oh, approximately 7 trillion inhabited worlds plus the architectural worlds equals exactly 7 trillion. You know, and that what you're heading for, you know, is all of the inhabited worlds and the architectural worlds are all of the same nature, and it's all one system with exactly 7 trillion worlds. See, and at that point, all of the boundaries disappear, you know, and you wouldn't have minor sector, major sector capitals outside. You got something?
Well, maybe it's answered in the next paragraph. You just said that, I don't know.
No, go ahead.
So, okay, about 980,000 billion years ago, you know, they said, oh, there's a room out here for a new universe, you know, and they start, you know, the investigators, and they're out there. There's a lot of, very possibly, there's a lot of local universes haven't even been created yet.
Right.
So there's got to be space.
Okay, now in that
in between or somewhere.
Well, okay, but remember how that works. Like, you know, the one part of the story of Nebadon that we know a lot of details about is the Andromeda Nebula. That portion of Nebadon, right, you know, that we're a part of. And remember that little spiral galaxy when it was initiated, that was completely outside of the Milky Way. That was initiated clear out, you know, like where the large and small Magellanic clouds, for instance, you know, clear outside of the disk of the Milky Way. See, so it's out there with nothing but space around it.
So?
Yeah, absolutely so.
Are all of them in?
Yeah, all of them are started up outside and brought in. The large and small Magellanic clouds is material coming
in.
In
Orvinton, right?
Yeah. Remember, Orvinton is not just the Milky Way.
Yeah, but so they're in Orvinton.
They're in Orvinton. They're in that, you know, that seventh segment of the donut of space.
So what you're saying is, okay, the Milky Way is only the
Milky Way is the core.
So every time new one's created, is it, you know, if it's not within the ones that are there, it's got to be without, and then the next one without outside of it?
No. I mean, remember, this is very. We're about to get to this actually in the next paragraph.
Okay, fine. Let's
but
let's wait.
Okay. No, but let me just put this up front. Constructing a local universe. You don't construct. You know, before there is a creator son and a creative spirit, there isn't a local universe. You don't make local universes, and then they come out to inhabit them. They're about to point out, there's just all kinds of nebulae that are coming into existence, and gravity is pulling them in to the Milky Way. And as they're coming in, the power beings are riding them in, and there's power beings in the Milky Way galaxy itself, and they're coordinating, bringing this material into the galaxy, getting it incorporated into the system. You know, we talked about that some back at the beginning of part two. It's a very complicated process. It all goes on before there's any creator son or creator mother spirit.
It takes hundreds of billions of years.
It takes an extremely long span of time. We don't know how long, it takes. Probably takes trillions of years in some cases, for this stuff to come in and actually get incorporated in.
They sort of described how ours started.
Right, but that's...
They found an area.
But that's not our local universe. That's just one tiny part of our local universe. Remember, we're going to get to that here in just a second. The Andromeda Nebula. But we'll get to that in just a second.
Got a question.
Yep.
John's asking, why do they use the term certainly twice?
Right, I tried to stress that. It's certainly pervaded, meaning, like I said, if you can see that spirit energy or mind energy presence, if you had the eyes to see that, it would be very definitively here. It's not some vague, misty, something. It's a substance that's filling space. Spirit is a substance. It's there's no gaps in it. It's not thin in any way. Okay. It's very much pervading. It's certainly there. Bonk, bonk, bonk. You can hit your head against it. Okay. All right? Okay, and in the same way, when they say, it certainly terminates, just as definitively that it's there, it definitively comes to an end. It's not like the atmosphere of the Earth, that it gets thinner and thinner and just fades into the background, the interstellar background. No, there's a wall, boundary. Like we've said, if you're traveling in a spaceship, you're plugged into her mind, and then you take that last foot of movement and everyone in the spacecraft comes unplugged because you go outside of that boundary. Okay? There's no slowly losing consciousness as you go into the mists, drifting off the edge of her boundary. I mean, she's just like my body has a sharp boundary, hers does too. Okay? There's a skin, if you will. Okay? And she's all within that boundary. Definitively, no bits trickling out or anything. Okay, so that's why they're trying to stress that. Okay, so let's get to this next one, and then we'll see a little bit more about this. They're sort of bringing together things they've said in other places back in part one and at the beginning of part two, and trying to get us to think about it all together here.
While the administrative organization of the grand universe discloses a clear-cut division between the governments of the central, super, and local universes. And while these divisions are astronomically paralleled in the space separation of Havona and the seven super universes, no such clear lines of physical demarcation set off the local creations. Even the major and minor sectors of Orvinton are, to us, clearly distinguishable. But it is not so easy to identify the physical boundaries of the local universes. This is because these local creations are administratively organized in accordance with certain creative principles governing the segmentation of the total energy charge of a super universe. Whereas their physical components, the spheres of space, suns, dark islands, planets, etc., take origin primarily from nebulae, and these make their astronomical appearance in accordance with certain pre-creative transcendental plans of the architects of the master universe.
Okay, pretty big paragraph of a number of things there, but Why don't we deal with that contrast that they're highlighting with the italicized words? Why don't we start there, and then we'll pick through some of the other parts. Okay, so like we've talked about, there's a whole process that goes on before you have a creative spirit going out to a location within the disk of the Milky Way, in our case. Long before that, first the Master Force organizers, who are getting the all those little spiral nebulae spun up, first they're in play, and that's completely outside of the Milky Way, off somewhere within, in our case, within the space segment that is Orvinton. Okay, and you have not a quote-unquote creative process, but a pre-creative process. Transcendental, they say. Remember this, think about it more truthfully. Think about what comes into existence from a finite experiential perspective as coming down from above. Starts at the absolute level, comes down through the absonite, through the transcendental domain, and then begins to manifest as the finite. Okay? That's actually how everything comes into existence. It doesn't start at the finite and then somehow magically culminate in the absolute. It's like, well, yeah, but how could that work? You know, when I have to have the absolute before I can start with the finite? Yeah, that's because, see, technically it's coming down. It's just you experience it bottom up, but that's not the way it existentially came into existence. And so before there's a creative process, a temporal process, there is time transcendent process that's coming down and beginning to manifest, and it doesn't show a very immediate definitive nature. It seems a little fuzzy to begin with. You know, look out in the outer space levels. There's nothing that looks very well organized. Everything just seems to be going in every which direction. You know, giant galaxies are slamming into each other out there, and, you know, it's like, that doesn't look like Havona. You know, that looks really chaotic and fuzzy. Doesn't look crystallized into some eternal perfection. Looks like the antithesis of it. Same thing here. It starts out, it seems like, well, okay, huh, there's a little spiral galaxy being spun up over there. Huh, okay, and now there's one over there. I mean, all the power beings are going, they never know where they're going to be. It's all way above their pay grade. The force organizers and the master architects, transcendental beings, are bringing this down from above. And then, here it is. And so they're going, oh, goodness, there's going to be one there? Oh, man, we've got to change all of our plans. As we bring that in, that's going to mess up those three local universes. And, I mean, it's a huge logistics problem for these power beings to take, a precursor that they do not have any anticipation of, get a hold of it. Like I was saying, once the force organizers get it spun up and beginning to actualize from those initial potentials to the point where you have automatons, as soon as that whirl in the force charge begins to coalesce into automatons, the associate transcendental master force organizers let go of it and the power beings move in. And like I said, they ride it in, and they begin to take a hold of it and coordinate it, and try to get organized as it's coming into the galaxy and then get it integrated in. Okay.
Yep. When you say ride it in, are they directing it?
They're out there in it.
Hanging on.
Yeah. I mean, they go out and they're standing on objects in that galaxy, and riding it in. Standing on dark islands, whatnot. I mean, initially, obviously, some of them, would be just co-located with it. But the more there's places to stand, they're standing somewhere, and they're
trying to take it somewhere.
They're bringing it into the Milky Way galaxy. It's all very literal. It's something that is not even remotely imaginable to current science. That when you look through a telescope at the large and small Magellanic clouds, there's a whole bunch of power beings there. Working with that, as it's getting as those two little spiral galaxies are getting closer and closer to the Milky Way galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy's tidal, gravity tidal forces are beginning to, you know, they started out as nice little discs, and they're being all pulled apart by tidal, differential tidal forces, you know. And they have to manage all of that and bring it in. They can't just have those stars in that galaxy fly into the Milky Way every which place. I mean, you've got some local universe that's been settled in the seventh stage of light and life for, you know, 10 trillion years. You can't just plop a bunch of matter in there and disrupt that whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah, it's a very complex problem. Okay? And so to think of that, you know, that there is a, you know, a pre-creative, you know, where you're using that word creative in the, you know, in just the, in the specific sense of when you do finite bringing into existence and, you know, and coordinating as deity, as personalized deity, it's creativity. Pre-creative, if it's transcendent of that. But they bring, they get this in, and like in the, you know, you've got several different local universe precursors roughed out in the Milky Way galaxy now. And there's creator sons back on Paradise, and they're looking out, you know, and they're about ready to go out and do their thing with their creative spirit consort. And they're looking out at these roughed out local universes, quote-unquote local universes, pre-local universes. And they, you know, I'm going to do that one. Okay, and they head out, and then they start, they have plans, creative plans that don't just involve matter, but mind and spirit and beings, and all of that has to be brought into a coordinated system. And so then the power beings start working with that creator son and his unique plans, and they start reorganizing, they start moving, you know, moving the furniture around, and, you know, getting it set up the way that that creative pair want it to be. And like I said, the creative spirit is actually very intimately involved in the big picture engaging of the physical, where the power beings are doing more of the micromanagement stuff. Yeah.
When the creative spirit and the creative son pick the, okay, we're going to set up there.
Right.
Is there mass in that area?
Right. It's, all of the mass is there.
Okay, fine. So they come in and then the power. Bring it, okay.
Right. All of the mass, I mean, the that's why I see they're trying to point out, just like they said there, whereas their physical components, the question you just asked, all the mass stuff, okay, the spheres of space, suns, dark islands, planets, etc., take origin primarily from nebulae, and these make their astronomical appearance in accordance with certain pre-creative. Okay, the creator sun, creator mother spirit doesn't have anything to do with the collection of energy that's there. They just go in and do something creative with those raw materials. Okay, now, and it's, you know, just how little do they have to say about what set of raw materials they're working with? Okay, that where they said the segmentation of the total energy charge of a super universe, that line in there. Do you remember when we talked about that way back? Let's see, what paper is this? This is... in paper 15, when they pointed out, they used that exact same sequence of words, and they said each local universe embraces exactly 1/100,000th part of the total energy charge of a super universe. There's that sequence of words. Okay, that segmentation they're talking about is that. The total energy in the super universe segment is exactly partitioned now into 100,000, you know, parts, segmentations, as they're saying there, individuations, sets. And so they have just that. They have exactly 1/100,000th of the total energy, which, you know, is not just matter, but all of the, you know, stuff that's more fundamental than matter, energy in the general sense. That's what they're working with. And, you know, think about this. There's energy. We talked about the whole energy grid that the power being set up. And a local universe has energy being pumped into it through the grid and stuff. Well, and all, I mean, if nothing else, all the stars are giving off light. All those photons, you know, they don't get to the boundary of the creative mother spirit and stop. you know, they go out. You got all kinds of, we couldn't see anything outside of our local universe, right? I mean, so you got energy pouring out and energy coming in, and that's kept in balance. So everyone has 1/100,000th. So there's this active, you know, divisioning, partitioning that's going on all the time. It's not a static thing where you get the cookie cutter out at the beginning and you're done with that. That's constantly being managed every nanosecond. That's being managed, that balance. Okay? Right. It involves a number of beings that's beyond our numerical concept. Remember? Okay? When I say they're riding it, they're everywhere. Okay? And these power beings, you know, are just, you know, there's so many of them, it's almost as if they're ubiquitous. And, you know, especially when you start talking about Frandalanx. So that's what's going on. And that issue of, you know, keeping that exactly, we were just saying, well, probably seems logical that until everything is done, you know, at the very least, the super universe headquarters worlds, the major sector headquarters worlds, the minor sector headquarters worlds, those are outside of local universes. You know, so that's some energy that's not inside a local universe. So you've got a little bit of mystery exactly how, you know. But nonetheless, other than those little question marks like that, you know, and the stuff like you were saying that's kind of, you know, what about the stuff that's way outside of the Milky Way right now, you know, and is in the early stages, you know. I mean, eventually it's all going to be collected together into one system, and new things won't be created out there. So the exactly, you know, is a curious statement. There's a mystery that you can't quite answer, exactly how you define exactly. But nonetheless, it's a very precise thing that is being constantly managed. And then all of that issue is happening at the same time that what they're pointing out. You've got basic, you know, astronomy going on still, astronomic systems and gravitational, you know, a grouping of all that mass, all that matter. And they're pointing out when you know, if you get way above everything, if you went way up, you know, in the master universe and looked down on the super universe, on the grand universe, you know, first of all, it's very obvious where the central universe is in contrast to the super universe space level. You know, here's the central universe with the dark gravity bodies all the way around it. And, you know, and then the seven super universes around that, it's like they said there, that's a very, you know, you can see that boundary by just looking at the stuff. You know, there's a big gap of nothingness between the dark gravity bodies and the first mass, you know, that's in the super universe space level. Same way as you go around the super universe space level, you know, where you imagine taking, you know, you've got this toroidal volume of space around the central universe, like a donut, you know, and you break it into seven super universes by taking a knife and slicing that donut into seven equal length segments. And so a super universe is inside those two vertical walls, you know, and the, you know, the tube boundaries, inner, outer, top, and bottom of the tube. And, you know, if you look at that, there's not matter, you know, on the boundary between two super universes, you know, half in one, half in another. I mean, there's a definite void of nothing, you know, around that boundary, like they're saying. That's very clearly marked by the mass of it and the gravitational collection of it. And as you zero in, obviously the large spiral galaxy that's the center of each of those seven segments, like in our case, the Milky Way galaxy, I mean, that's a very definitive object. You know, you don't have stars, matter equally distributed throughout the whole region. It's, you know, down there in the Milky Way galaxy, pretty much. A few other little things that are on their way in is all you have spread around it. And if you zero in on the disk of the Milky Way, as they're saying, it's very definitive where the 10 pi wedges are, that are the 10 major sectors. You know, they are clearly marked by, you know, you look at glowing stars, and there are gaps where there aren't glowing stars between those 10 pi wedges. So it's not like looking at the galaxies in the outer space levels, which are smooth, because there aren't power beings that have organized that matter. It's still in that unorganized state. The Milky Way galaxy doesn't look like the Andromeda galaxy, nice and smooth like that. It's very much broken up into 10 pi wedges, which are maintained, because obviously normal gravitational phenomena is not going to maintain pi wedges going around. You know, that has to be controlled and maintained by the power beings. And then they say even you can zoom in and you can see, you know, here's a glowing group of stars, and here's a glowing group of stars, and here's a glowing group of stars, and each one of those is one of the minor sectors. Okay? They're demarked as if they were just a gravitational collection of matter. But as you zoom in to the next level, the local universe, no. You know, it says even to them, it's not so easy to identify the physical boundaries of the local universes. That's another thing that makes you think, well, they go, okay, so there's Salvington. So I know that the Nebadon is the sphere around that. I can visualize that. I mean, they can't anticipate the shape. See, I don't think. Let me think about that statement. You know, if someone says, here's the boundaries of Nebadon, oh, okay, now that you point it out, I see that stuff is being kept, especially if you watch it for a while, you notice that all that matter stays together, okay? And the matter next to it stays with it. You know, you say, oh, over time I can see that but just glancing at it, where the other ones you can just see a minor sector in the moment. You know, you'd have to follow the local universes and notice that you've got a bunch of matter here and a bunch of matter here, and the two never mix together. They stay separated. You know, and there's some sort of a irregular boundary, you know, in the same way that my hand is not a circle. It's got an irregular boundary. You can picture that her body has, you know, has some sort of irregular boundary. Imagine away, you know, whatever you want to picture.
Okay. Yeah, your analogy of the states is a very good one.
Right. But it appears that it's probably the case that where there are local universes set up, at least, you know, once you're down the road a little bit, you don't just have one local universe in the super universe, you know. Once there's a number of them, they're tending to a state where there aren't gaps. They're butted up against each other, just like the states are. Okay. And they tell you that when all those local universes are on the central universe side, you know, because they're going around the Milky Way in our case, when they're on the Havona side, the dark gravity bodies exert a huge tidal influence, you know, and they actually get much piled up on top of each other and closer together, and then when they come back around to the far outside, like we are right now, they get spread out more. See, so just think of that dynamic too. Those power beings have to keep that going, you know, without anything getting shuffled together. No one's star, you know, dribbles over into some other local universe. Okay, they're all being kept together. So it's a very complex phenomenon. And this is why they were really emphasizing that first one, that the boundary, to find the boundary of Nebadon, don't imagine going up and looking for, well, there's this cluster and this cluster and this cluster, and then there's nothing really around it, and that must be Nebadon.
Just get in your spaceship until you pass out.
Right, yeah. It just, you know, keep going at different vectors, and it's like you pass out, okay, there's the boundary there, and you back up. You have the autopilot back up. And, right, yeah, you can do it that way. But that's why they were stressing in that first paragraph, you know, these are very much not pre-creative elements that are basically being ruled by gravity and other physical forces. They're creative elements. They're fundamentally defined by the presence of a creative mother spirit. That's first. The matter is second. The matter is being made to conform to an overarching deity presence that's imposing creativity upon it.
And a plan.
And a plan, right. Right. Okay. Let's see what else they tell us here.
One or more, even many, such nebula, maybe
nebulae,
yeah, may be encompassed within the domain of a single local universe, even as Nebadon was physically assembled out of the stellar and planetary progeny of Andromeda and other nebulae. The spheres of Nebadon are of diverse nebular ancestry, but they all had a certain minimum commonness of space motion, which was so adjusted by the intelligent efforts of the power directors as to produce our present aggregation of space bodies, which travel along together as a contiguous unit over the orbits of the superuniverse.
Why don't you read that last little chapter?
Such is the constitution of the local star cloud of Nebadon, which today swings in an increasingly settled orbit about the Sagittarius center of that minor sector of Orbiton to which our local creation belongs.
Okay, so as I was saying earlier, here they're reminding you again. We at the beginning of part three, we get this very detailed story of the Andromeda spiral nebula and its evolution to eventually a system of stars, you know, from just gas until eventually it's a system of stars and planets, and one of those stars is our sun. But as we talked about, you know, back when we were dealing with this in the bigger picture, the Andromeda nebula, remember, it only produced about a million stars, far short of what we need to make a whole local universe. Remember when they were giving you kind of the ratios of how many systems, physical systems, it took to get the 619 inhabited worlds of Satania so far. You know, when we were doing some back-of-the-envelope calculations, one of the things we did was using a number that we're going to come upon here shortly. We were trying to estimate. It's like, well, you know, if you think about the number of stars that you have locally here to get a local system, and you extrapolate that up to a whole local universe, you know, multiply by 100 to get a constellation, another 100 to get a local universe. On the one hand, we were looking at that. It's like, well, it looks like, you know, you're probably going to need, you know, at least 8 other collections as big as the Andromeda Nebula. In other words, the Andromeda Nebula is about a ninth of all of Nebadon. And the number we're about to come up on, if you extrapolate that, that's kind of giving you another endpoint. It's like, well, maybe it's not even that much. Maybe Andromeda is only like a 20th of Nebadon. Okay, so when they say one or more, even many, okay, you know, we're definitely in the many ballpark. There were
a lot of other ones that were bigger.
Right, there maybe there was, you know, 3 of them that were really huge that, you know, were, you know, or whatever. But see, you know, you can, you know, there's no, we don't have any details here. But you know, you can tell that, you know, when they say that Nebadon are of a diverse nebular ancestry, diverse sounds like maybe more than 3.
Another way to look at it also is the amount of planets that are in a solar system sometimes with the number of stars. So I think you're about right.
Right. I mean, that's that, you know, the first one, right. You remember it gave you how many, you know, inhabited worlds are, you know, by themselves in a star system, how many, you know, there's 2 inhabiteds, and how many had 3 and how many had 4 and
like 5 or something.
Or, you know, and 4, and there was 5 of them that had more than 2, if you remember. That's the way that, you know, that was back at the beginning of part 2 here that we went through that little calculation. You know, and to get to 619 inhabited worlds that we have so far, heading towards 1,000, it took 562 systems. OK, Okay, and then the other thing you don't know is like, well, how many of those 562 systems have more than one star?
Or could be dark gravity bodies, which
perhaps. Right. I mean, right. But
anyway, I'm sorry.
But anyway, I mean, you know, you get the point. There's a lot of variables here, and so you know, you can do some back of the envelope speculations and try to get some ballpark ideas of what's going on, and that's what we were doing. So you know, we know that it's most likely, you know, a many sort of a situation for us. You know, that mere million suns that came out of the Andromeda Nebula is not even close to getting it done. You're not going to get 10 million inhabited worlds out of those million stars. And then notice how getting that raw pre-local universe set up. See that but they all had a certain minimum commonness of space motion. Right, see, if stuff is coming into the Milky Way galaxy, certain amount of matter is all kind of going in a reasonably similar direction in this neck of the woods, and so they then zoom in and really get that collected together.
Is that paradise gravity,
Brit? No, the power beings are doing that. The power beings are you know, they're working with the gravity. Managing the gravity with their anti-gravity presence, they're managing that and moving the material around and getting it. And it's like, okay, all this stuff is kind of already heading naturally in the same direction. It's a lot less work to handle the stuff that's already kind of naturally going in the same direction, rather than taking stuff that's going in every which direction and having to completely redo its natural paths to get it going in the same direction. Okay, so that's what they do. They work with what the transcendental beings have set up, and I'm sure they discover over time, coincidentally, it's not extremely difficult. Stuff that initially seems to be kind of random, when it all starts jostling together, doesn't take a lot of micromanagement. I mean, remember, the transcendental beings have a very transcendent perspective on this. They will know how to set things up that for us seems random, but over time, we discover it's not random at all. It comes together in very subtle ways and very helpful ways. Okay, so that's what's going on. All right, and so like they're saying, the power directors get a hold of it, and they hold it together as a contiguous unit. Okay, and the thing that's really profound about that, if you've ever had an introductory astronomy course, you know, and they told you about spiral galaxies, like they imagine the Milky Way is, just like, you know, all the ones we see out in the outer space levels. They say, the big thing is about a spiral galaxy, there's differential rotation. It doesn't rotate like a record platter. Okay, it's like the planets in the solar system. You know, you don't have Mercury, you know, and Jupiter going like this around the sun, like they were glued to a record platter, staying on the same radial line. Okay, Mercury is zipping around and Jupiter's putzing along relative to that. Okay, there's differential revolution of the planets. Okay, the galaxy's the same way. The stuff in the center is going around, you know, faster than the stuff outside. So you know, if you just drew a circle on the disk of the galaxy and imagine, said this is Nebadon, and you let that thing just differentially rotate twice around, that parts of that circle would be spread over the entire disk in just a couple rotations. Just like putting a drop of chocolate, you know, syrup on the surface of a glass of milk, because you have a spoon in there, and then start gently stirring that. And you watch that little drop of chocolate stretch out into a thin thing. And then very quickly, it's uniformly spread over the whole surface of the milk. It doesn't take 5 million revolutions. You know, it spreads out really quickly. See, but the Nebadon doesn't do that. They're having to resist, you know, at doing that. I mean, and it's been around for a trillion years. You know, it's gone around the center of the galaxy several times, okay, and it hasn't spread out over the whole disk. They have a huge job constantly to work against that differential rotation and keep it together as a contiguous unit. Right? Huge task. And there's this is another reason why you might suspect that there's maybe some dynamic nature to her body shape. She probably ebbs and flows some to be nicely in sync with all of this. Okay? And so the shape of the local universe and everyone probably changes with time. Sometimes it's, you know, not as wide as it is now, or it's wider than it is now, or it's thicker than it is now, or thinner than it is now. Okay? That probably part of the process.
Yeah, she goes on a diet or she eats too much.
So then the only other thing in there is another very important thing that a lot of readers have been very confused about over the years, that I tried to really get pinned down back when we were dealing with that, you know, in part one. Okay, that what you see in the last little bit there, you know, the whole bit about such is the constitution of the local star cloud of Nebadon, which today swings. You've got to notice the word swings. In an increasingly settled orbit about the Sagittarius center of that minor sector of Orvinton of which our local creation belongs. Okay, the Nebadon is one of 100 local universes in our minor sector. Okay, and remember what they said, if you could get up, you could see, oh, that little blob right there, that's their minor sector. Okay, it's a localized, you know, phenomenon in the disk of the galaxy. Okay, and the center, that thing is in motion. It's rotating, but it's not, this center they're talking about is not within the boundaries of the minor sector. It's off in the center of the Milky Way galaxy, that Sagittarius center. Remember, if you look towards the constellation Sagittarius, you're looking towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy, the central bulge of the Milky Way galaxy. Okay. That, you know, star cloud of our minor sector is swinging around the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Swinging, you know, not rotating about something, a point inside of its space. It's swinging. How does a swing work? Okay, the minor sector is like the seat of the swing. When a swing moves, is it rotating about some point in the seat? No, it's rotating about that point way off above the seat of the swing that's attached to the crossbar, the swing set. Okay? That rotation center is like the center of the Milky Way galaxy. The seat is like the minor sector. If you misinterpret that...
Yeah, I'm misinterpreting it right now.
If you misinterpret that and you put the center in the minor sector, that turns... that means our minor sector is the Milky Way galaxy. And all of a sudden, in order to get a super universe, you've got to take some vast collection of galaxies in the first outer space level to create a super universe out of. No. Okay? And it's like, well, how do you know that you should interpret swing so precisely? Because if you read every sentence in the book, it tells you very specifically that there's only one major galaxy in Orvinton. The Milky Way galaxy. So if you're going to rationalize every sentence in the book, you've got to keep that in mind. You can't go, well, this defines it right here. All I need to know is this. The minor sector is Milky Way galaxy. It's like, well, then your conclusion is in disagreement with other sentences in the book. Well, that's probably because those sentences are false.
So the swing, can you describe that again?
Again, think about a swing set.
Okay, so where
a swing rotates when it swings. Does it rotate about a point within the seat?
No.
It rotates about a point way outside of where you sit, way removed from where you sit. Does the Earth move around the sun where the sun is inside the Earth? No. Sun is, you know, that gravitational center that the Earth is moving around is way outside of the Earth's boundaries. The Earth swings around the Sun.
So Nebadon is, well, when you look at a picture of the Milky Way, the Sagittarius arm is like the fifth arm.
Again, you can't, no one can give you a picture of the Milky Way galaxy. All those pictures are false.
Oh, okay.
You can't go by any of that stuff.
You know what I'm talking about.
Right, I know what you're talking about. You can't try to rationalize a false picture to the truth. The Revelation, remember, anything the Revelation says, they can say that because you can't figure it out. We can't figure it out.
So you say your cosmology may change.
But again, not because this book is in error. It's the authoritative elimination of error. So it has no errors in it. Okay. It's trying to give you the actual picture. You know, when it, you know, they tell you they know the Sagittarius arm, the Orion arm, blah, blah, blah. They know all this stuff, and they know, you know, this is 25,000 light years. It's like, you know, none of that can be valid because you know you're 200,000 light years from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Well, they don't even think there's enough room for that fact. The Revelation is telling you that we're way off in our picture. And we'll see that in a little bit, even with trying to figure out the size of Antares. Okay, they give you the size, and you go, well, that doesn't agree with what science says. Well, remember, the only reason they could give you that is because anything science gives you is not going to agree with it. If the science can get you the same answer the Urantia book gives, then the revelators are in rebellion. They're not allowed to give you something that you can figure out yourself. So anything that, if science can, you know, has gotten an answer, supposedly, it must be in disagreement with the Revelation. Otherwise, this Revelation is invalid. It doesn't, it's not self-consistent. It would be a violation of the revelatory mandate. They tell you they can't give you something you can correctly figure out yourself. So if they give you a fact like that, it's because you can't get the correct answer. They're giving you the data point you need to properly calibrate your measurements and get things correct. You may have a precise system, but you don't have an accurate one because it's not calibrated.
So that's what about the
you step on the scale, and it's not zero before you step on it. It's at 150 pounds.
Okay, so back to the thing. I'm just trying to picture the Nebadon, okay?
So
you've got the center of the Milky Way, which is some ideas.
Way off, 200,000 light years away.
The Nebadon itself is moving around that.
Nebadon and the whole and all the other 99 local universes that are with it, that whole minor sector is just going around, revolving around and around
it's
the center of the disk.
Revolving around the minor sector.
There is motion within the minor sector too.
Okay.
You know, and within the local universe, and within our part that has the Andromeda. You know, there's all kinds of internal motions with centers of gravity, but the one they're talking about here is the swing. Not the internal revolution, rotations.
The universe is doing the same thing.
All 100, you know, are swinging. And like they're saying, over time, these collections of 100 local universes, the minor sectors, get more and more settled into nice, stable orbits about the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Meanwhile, they swing.
And the same goes with other minor sectors, correct?
Yeah, every minor sector is at some radial distance out from the center. You know, the Sagittarius subgalactic center, you know, is that central bulge of the Milky Way galaxy.
Wow.
You know, remember they describe it like that earlier in the book. You know, so it's no mystery about what they're talking about. Sagittarius is not a place. Sagittarius is a direction. You know, readers don't know astronomy, they see Sagittarius, they think that's a place. No, it's because they don't know astronomy. Sagittarius or Orion or, you know, whatever is not a place. It's a direction in the sky. The Sagittarius center is saying the center of the Milky Way galaxy is in that direction in the sky, not in that place. Okay. Now, a major sector goes all the way in to the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and that's why, and they're talking about that, or, you know, back in the early part of the book, they point out, yeah, you know, that central part, every major sector has part of that central part, is part of the major sector. But a minor sector is out here separate from that central region, some distance, shorter, far.
But there's minor sectors closer in.
Right, this minor sector is going to be right in there close, yeah. I mean, you would guess that the central bulge is actually broken up into minor sectors, so there's going to be minor sectors within that, even. But anyway, that's... No, I mean, I knew this was going to generate a long discussion because it always does. There's lots of decades-old confusion about this that has to be cleared up if you're going to understand what the revelators are saying. Now, you're looking for an interpretation that doesn't have to throw out or ignore any sentence in the book. The book will help you to figure out when your initial assumption is false. You know, start with what you can remember and put forward an initial assumption, then try to run with it and see if you can find a sentence somewhere that refutes it. Now, that's what you're trying to do.
What about this section where Revelation is not necessarily inspired, where it talks about...
Well, okay, we'll get into that sometime, but you have to very carefully think through that. I'm not ignoring that. That doesn't refute that. But, you know, you probably don't want me to talk for a half hour trying to understand, you know, to help you understand that.
I figured.
All this stuff is very complicated. You know, it takes years and years of very precise, methodical thinking to sort it all out. Lots of false starts. You try this, and it looks great for a year or two, and then you find this really unfortunate sentence. And you throw it all out, and you start all over again. Okay, and that sort of courageous thinking has been lacking. People who have found an initial interpretation, they stick with it even when they find that sentence, and then they declare that they found an error in the book or something like this. It's like, no, you've found an error in your initial assumption. Try a better one. And don't stop until you find one that isn't refuted after you carefully compare it to every single word in the book, not just 10 words in two papers, every word. Something in the Jesus papers could refute your astronomical interpretation. You got to take every sentence into account. Okay? All right, so that's, so anyway, you know, if you want to go, you know, get back into that some more, you can go back when I went through that hierarchy of as they go out from the small local motions to the bigger and bigger motions. There's a set of bullet points, you know, and in that, at the appropriate point, they call the motion a swing, just so that you aren't thinking, oh, I've got a region here and it's orbiting about some interior center of gravity point. They purposely use the word swing so that you don't do that. You know, search for the use of the word swing every time in the book. You'll see it's very precisely used when the center about which you're rotating is outside of what you're thinking of rotating, not inside of what you think of rotating. All right, now, after that very brief introduction, we're going to get into, you see, if you flip to the, look at the titles of these first two sections, like I said up front, they're about the power beings, taking the story from that general perspective in paper 29 into a little more specificity here. So let's do that.
Section 1, the Nebulon Power Centers. The spiral and other nebulae the mother wheels of the spheres of space are initiated by Paradise Force organizers and following nebular evolution of gravity response, they are superseded in super universe function by the power centers and physical controllers, who thereupon assume full responsibility for directing the physical evolution of the ensuing generations of stellar and planetary offspring. This physical supervision of the Nebulon pre-universe was, upon the arrival of our Creator Son, immediately coordinated with his plan for universe organization. Within the domain of this Paradise Son of God, the supreme power centers and the master physical controllers collaborated with the later appearing Marantia power supervisors and others to produce that vast, complex, of communication lines, energy circuits, and power lanes which firmly bind the manifold space bodies of Nebulon into one integrated administrative unit.
Okay, so you can bind it, you know, that's the word, you can bind it into one integrated administrative unit because first it's bound into one contiguous, maintained contiguous physical unit. And obviously, it wouldn't do you any good to set up a bunch of energy lines if it starts stretching out and snapping your lines.
It's infrastructure.
You know, it can't. It's got to stay, you know, located, because those energy lines are between worlds, you know, anchor points. Okay, so you know, so you can see they're basically just saying what we've already covered really well with the pre-universe fact that you've got this long process between when the associated transcendental master force organizers leave any given little spiral nebulae that they and the primaries have spun up outside of the disk of the Milky Way. Like I said, they're following nebular evolution of gravity response. That means as soon as the primaries get the whirl spun up in the force charge, and then the associates condense that whirl into ultimatons, or begin the condensation into ultimatons. And as soon as you have ultimatons forming, then they leave and the power beings come in. Unless it's in the outer space levels, where there are no power beings, and then the associate ones stay with, you know, like we've said, you know, think about a Hubble, picture, say, of, you know, thousands and thousands of galaxies, you know, in a field of view. Every one of those galaxies has got a collection of associate transcendental master force organizers riding with that galaxy. And they've been riding with it for trillions of years, maybe. Just like the power beings stick with the matter out there, every one of those things is a little pocket of beings. Okay, but in here, they're only there for a short time. As soon as you start to get ultimatons, you know, long before those ones in the outer space levels, you know, we got stars and all those galaxies we're looking out there. You know, long before you have stars or anything, just getting ultimatons going, the force organizers leave, and the power beings come in. And they manage things from there forward as it comes into the Milky Way and it gets organized. Let's see, anything else in there? You notice that as soon as they mentioned upon the arrival of our Creator Son, immediately coordinated. Okay, they didn't say creative, you know, spirit or creative mother spirit directly there, but you know, the only way he can coordinate anything is through her. She's the coordinating fact. You know, coordinate is a mother word. I see. So they're just reminding you, you know, that, you know, it's her ubiquitous presence and direct engagement. It's through her that he, you know, his plan gets imposed. Just like it's through her that his spirit of truth gets to you. It can't get to you directly. It's only through her. She's the means to the end always. The mother is the way. All right?
100 supreme power centers of the fourth order are permanently assigned to our local universe. These beings receive the incoming lines of power from the third order centers of Eversa and relay the downstepped and modified circuits to the power centers of our constellations and systems. These power centers, in association, function to produce the living systems of control and equalization, which operates to maintain the balance and distribution of otherwise fluctuating and variable energies. Power centers are now, however, concerned with transient and local energy upheavals.
Yeah, are not, however. I think you said now, didn't you?
Yeah.
Power centers are not, however.
That's...
Oh, another?
That's a...
Not a little blooper? Okay.
Power centers are not, however...
Well, that's a crazy huge...
Concerned... transient and local energy upheavals, such as sunspots and system electric disturbances. Light and electricity are not the basic energies of space, They are secondary and subsidiary manifestations.
Okay, so that last part is a little reminder, as we stressed before when we were talking about the power beings. In general, they're working with sub-electronic level energies. They're working with energy below what we recognize. You know, in our current physics, when we have a capital E for energy in some equation, that's the only energy we know, electronic level energy. You know, the most fundamental nuggets of which are things like photons, electrons, neutrinos, you know, what have you. Okay, you know, so like light, electricity, you know, photons, charged particles, okay, electronic level stuff. That's not primarily what they're working with. That's secondary and subsidiary manifestations. They're fundamentally working with the sub-electronic level energies.
Like an automaton?
From an automaton up to the electronic level, you know, so that whole intervening space. You know, initially they're working with the automatons, but all the way up, and you know, by and large, they aren't working with it once it gets up to the electronic level. There are exceptions. If you remember back when we were reading about the power beings, and let me just the reason I'm flipping back is we're going to come up on this. There are these different types of power beings. You had the associate power directors. You had the mechanical controllers, you had the energy transformers, you had the energy transmitters, you had the primary associators, the secondary dissociators, and then the Frandelangs. And remember when we were reading about the primary associators, they pointed out that they work with bigger stuff, manipulating atoms, electrons, and automatons. Okay, they're one of the exceptions. Because they actually are working with atoms, because they have to construct the actual initial prokaryotes, you know, those little terraforming machines, living machines that they're going to terraform a world and stuff. Okay, you know, they're assembling that loop of DNA and building the husk of it. And okay, but in general, except for exceptions like that, you know, those other power beings I just read are only working with the sub-electronic, and the electronic stuff is kind of just working with the natural laws that govern those phenomena. Now, that's why when we carefully study all kinds of electric level phenomena, you know, we don't have these huge gaps in our equations where there's this giant mystery that we have to insert. You know, that's because a being is, you know, in that place in the equation. But if we were studying what was going on with the sub-electronic level domain, we knew anything about that, you know, we would have all kinds of gaps in our analysis, because that's, you can't ignore the beings, you know, they're heavily manipulating that domain, you know, so your equal signs would never work, you know, as you tried to set up your equations. But for us, like I said, that capital E energy, that electron, you know, the energy that they're working with is what we call E equals zero, you know. I mean, if you had an automaton somehow subjected to our measurement devices, that measurement device would measure energy equals zero, because it's all sub-electronic level energy. Even if you had just a mere collection of 100 automatons without any additional electronic level energy added to that, you know, the rotations that make it an electron or a photon or things like that, just the electronic level base of 100, that has E equals zero in our current physics. We have no knowledge of its existence. And because we don't know it exists, we have all sorts of very magical things that happen in interactions with particles that wouldn't be magical if we knew that thing that we think is zero was there. There's a lot of stuff like that. Okay, back to here. So back there in, you know, in that paper I'm going from, what is that? That's section 2 in paper 29. Remember they had those orders, the third order and the fourth order, these power beings. And, you know, they talked about how a local universe has 100 power centers coming from the 1,000 that are at the super universe a capital level above. The way, remember when we were going through that grid, so you have at the super universe capital level, you have 1,000 beaming, you know, one for each of the minor sectors. So our local universe gets energy as one of the 100 local universes in a given minor sector. It's not being beamed just to this local universe, it's being beamed to this minor sector. And then these 100 are picking it up out of that, you know, ubiquitous input. Okay, and you have 100 here because they're going to direct it to the 100 constellations. Okay, so that's the, you know, the next, you know, fork in the grid. All right, so that's what was going on there. And then the thing that we didn't have that we have here now is this detail that we were talking about a little bit. These power centers in association, function to produce the living system of control and equalization which operates to maintain the balance and the distribution of otherwise fluctuating and variable energies. Remember, we were talking about it. You have to have this exactly 1/100,000th portion maintained. You know, in and of itself, it would fluctuate. I mean, if there was no input into the system, you know, it would be endless photons leaving it. You know, and it would be diminishing in energy. Right, so there, you know, in and of itself, it's a variable phenomenon. Things are jostling around and whatnot, and they're micromanaging all of that and keeping it in balance. And they're basically doing that below the level of anything that we know about. Now, from current physics, they're working with, you know, ghosts. You know, they're working with phantoms, phantom energies. But they aren't. There's a whole sub-electronic level domain. you know, that's why the thing that we can see, for instance, might be unstable, like a uranium nucleus. You know, any of the elements bigger than bismuth, you know, bigger than element 83. We watch them and they fall apart. They're radioactive. You know, and we think it's magical. You know, literally, the physics that describes that is this, the initial assumption is it's magical. It's acausal. Okay, well, that's ridiculous. Something has to be causing it. Something is breaking it. It's like, well, there's nothing there. We've looked and looked and looked. There's nothing there. So nothing is breaking it. It's just self-breaking. No, the sub-electronic level domain, which is there and we can't see, is slamming into it and breaking it. You know, it's a causal phenomenon. It's not a causeless phenomenon like we currently believe. All right.
The 100 local universe centers are stationed on Salvington, where they function at the exact energy center of that sphere. Architectural spheres, such as Salvington, Edentia, and Jerison, are lighted, heated, and energized by methods which make them quite independent of suns of space. These spheres were constructed, made to order, by the power centers and physical controllers, and were designed to exert a powerful influence over energy distribution. Basing their activities on such focal points of energy control, the power centers, by their living presences, directionize and channelize the physical energies of space. And these energy circuits are basic to all physical, material, and Marantia spiritual phenomena.
Okay, why do they have that last physical, material, and Marantia spiritual? We're just focusing on the basically the material energy part of the picture here. Remember when we talked about the power beings, you know, they reminded us some in passing, you know, in those up in part one there, that you have a whole bunch of mostly unrevealed beings that work with spirit substance too in the same way. Okay, so here, you notice the second word in each of these hyphenated pairs, you know, are the two substances, matter and spirit. Okay, so they're saying whether or not you're talking about that which stems from the one substance, the physical things that stem from the literal matter, because there's a lot of energy phenomena that, you know, you wouldn't call matter, but they're physical, okay? All kind of founded on that one substance, matter. And then there's all of the Marantia things that are stemming off of the other substance, of spirit substance, you know, that involve physical energy as well, because Marantia is, you know, the weave of spirit and physical energy. So that which stems from both ends, you know, is involved. The power beings are involved in the whole process. You know, the one end and everything in between. The only thing they aren't involved in is the other end, the spirit, pure spirit substance end. Not the spirit controllers are working with that end of the equation. Let's see. Okay, you got this reminder that the architectural worlds are made to order, but now we're stressing the part, not so much the part that's made for the beings that inhabit those architectural worlds, but there's an awful lot that has nothing to do with beings directly, about the structure of these worlds. They're designed to be nodes in the energy grid. They're designed to be able to handle power beings locking onto them and grabbing a hold of the energy lines and not ripping the world apart. They're very rigid, very strong worlds. And then they also have all kinds of details within them that are completely, you know, incomprehensible to us, that help to work with the power being to do the power being's job of regulating everything. Okay, so all that's very fascinating stuff that we'll start learning about as soon as we get to the next life. You know, we're going to be on one of those architectural worlds in the next life, and you're going to start learning about all this stuff. It'll be very intimate to us in short order. Let's see, anything else in there? No, I think, go ahead.
So these magic worlds, or these
architectural
spheres, mm-hmm. Have multi-use. They're not just made up for us.
No.
They have a great deal more to do.
Right. I mean, we can't even remotely comprehend, I'm sure, all the different things that they're designed to do.
All about us.
Right, they're not just a place, you know, where you can walk around with bare feet, you know. You know, that's not the whole point. You know, it's to be a footpath for ascenders. The fun thing about, you know, where you have power beings actually on architectural worlds is, you know, you'll be able to get up close and, you know, with those activities. If the power beings, like we're about to read, are on a dark island of space, okay, you know, you and I are not going to be going over to a dark island, you know, that's going to be off limits. We're probably going to, maybe when we're finaliters, we could get, you know, into the, you know, up to close to a dark island of space. But I'm sure, you know, in the early stages, that would tear you apart. Only a power being can, you know, actually stand on one of those things and not be ripped to shreds. You know, if nothing else, not ripped to shreds, you know, flattened into a zero thickness pancake on its surface, you know, because of the extreme gravity. Right. Remember, just because you have a Marantia body doesn't mean you don't, you know, gravity's not holding you to that sphere. You know, you don't have to lock your talons into the, you know, the first mansion world to keep from floating off because you have a Marantia body. You know, gravity holds you to the ground just like it does now. Right. all right. Okay. So now they can, you know, give us, you know, this we have local exceptions to that rule of having the power beings on these architectural worlds.
10 supreme power centers of the fifth order are assigned to each of Nebadon's primary subdivisions, the 100 constellations. In Nerlashadek, your constellation, they are not stationed on the headquarters sphere, but are situated at the center of the enormous stellar system, which constitutes the physical core of the constellation. On Adentia, there are 10 associated mechanical controllers and 10 Frandalanks who are in perfect and constant liaison with the nearby power centers.
Okay, so the way this works, if the power centers are not literally on the architectural world, if they're nearby the headquarters, whichever headquarters it is, on a dark island, then you've got this little linkage that's set up to transfer what they would do, as they were saying in the previous one, to anchor the lighting, heating, and energizing of the architectural world. That part of their functioning of the center is transferred over, you know, in some sort of energy conduit that you probably don't want to stand in or fly through, you know, over to the architectural world, where it's, you know, picked up on the other end by these. Remember, these are non-personal master physical controllers, the mechanical controllers and the Frandelangs, 10 of each. You know, so it's just a simple, you know, there's 10 now because there's 10 fundamental forms of energy. So now you have, you know, you had 100 before because you had 100 constellations. Now you have 10, not because you have 10 local systems, but now it's in the mode where they're divided up between the 10 different forms of physical energy. And so each of them has a beam, you know, to a pair of mechanical controllers and Frandelangs. And the Frandelang is there as the, you know, the measuring device regulating this linkage. All right, so that's the way it's set up with the 10 that are in the Relationship. And that's, you know, we often bring up what they're going to say in the next paragraph about Gerasim. But don't forget that Nerlashadek is, you know, it's special in this way too, that that Nerlashadek has apparently an exceptionally large dark gravity body system in it. You know, that's the actual center of the system, as opposed to Edentia, you know, which is nearby. You know, so just, you know, be reminded of that it isn't all about, there's an architectural world, and that by definition then everything must be centered about it, as if there isn't any matter and it's not consequential, it's all just about spirit or something, right? No. Edentia gets bumped from the center point because there is an enormous stellar system with a dark gravity body in the center that actually anchors energy-wise our constellation. See, that's actually at the center. All right. Let's see. Yeah. And then you go to the next one here.
One supreme power center of the sixth order is stationed at the exact gravity focus of each local system. In the system of Satania, the assigned power center occupies a dark island of space located at the astronomic center of the system. Many of these dark islands are vast dynamos which mobilize and directionize certain space energies. And these natural circumstances are effectively utilized by the Satania Power Center, whose living mass functions as a liaison with the higher centers, directing the streams of more materialized power to the master physical controllers on the evolutionary planets of space.
Okay, see, so they took the opportunity in that paragraph to kind of give you a little more description of just how these centers are working in general. It's not just that one that works like that, but they're all like that. They just, you know, think of them in an extreme literal sense. They have a mass that is incomprehensible, you know, in terms of the size of their body. You know, and seeing how they were kind of explaining what I was saying in the previous one, that that it's not necessarily an architectural sphere that's at the gravitational center of a system or constellation. You know, they take a slightly secondary role if there's some really significant dark island system. And, you know, and it's interesting that in both cases, both our constellation and our local system is that way. So you're not going to be able to get up and close and personal with a power center anytime soon. You're going to have to wait until you get up to Salvington. Because our constellation, you know, unless you go to another constellation before that, you know, and go to a headquarters world before that, you know, or something like that, or another system. But, you know, if you're just making a beeline up from Gerasim to Edentia to Salvington, you know, you won't have the power center right there in the architectural world.
Well, these power centers, I mean, how personal are they?
They're very personal.
Well, they are.
Yeah, power centers are very personal. Right,
they're humongous, aren't they?
Yeah, they're gigantic beings, but they're definitive persons that you'll be able to go up and interact with personally.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, if you go back and, you know, and read paper 29, they make, you know, they're third source personalities. Okay. But they are very much personal beings.
Wow.
Okay. So that's what I was saying. You know, you won't be able to get up close and personal with one of these until you get to Salvington, unless you go to another constellation or system. All right. Now, when we get to the physical controllers, you know, we're going to bring in, you're going to see they're going to remind us of all those seven that I read back there. There's two of them that are personal and are overseeing things. Once you go from the very personal power centers down in the distribution grid. So let's get to them.
Section 2, the Satania physical controllers. While the master physical controllers serve with the power centers throughout the grand universe, their functions in a local system, such as Satania, are more easy of comprehension. Satania is one of 100 local systems which make up the administrative organization of the constellation of Nerlaeshadec, having as immediate neighbors the systems of Sandamacia, Asuncia, Porgia, or Porosia, Sortoria, Rentulia, and Glantonia. The Nerlaeshadec system differs in many respects, but all are evolutionary and progressive, very much like Satania.
Okay, now, when you're, you know, we're all struggling to try to figure out how to pronounce those, the key thing to remember is they're all using the Latin IA suffix, you know, which is because they're the equivalent of a nation in the hierarchy, you know, where you go from clan to tribe to nation to territorial state. Okay, so they're all given, you know, like India, you know, remember, India, the IA suffix doesn't, you know, specifically, historically, indicate a place. It's a people. It's a nation of people. And so you should pronounce them all with the IA suffix rather than, you know, because the T is not part of the suffix. You know, so you'd want to, it'd be something like Sandmatia. You know, Asuntia. Okay.
So why would they give us...
Yeah, but your rancha, the T is part of the suffix.
Why would they give us these names that probably aren't really the names or...
No, right, I was about to point that out. Now, I haven't figured out the etymology of any of these yet, just like I haven't figured out the local universe names that they give us too. Something I got to do at some point. But the whole point, you know, is to, you know, is for us to... You know, get into the etymology and unpack these. They're giving you a little clue about you know, some aspect of these. It may not necessarily be the character of that local system. It could be something like maybe the different etymologies indicate that one's kind of to the west, that one's kind of the north or something. You never know. You got to stay open. You know, and trying to figure out the etymologies and see what it is that they're trying to give you a clue of. You know, like Nerlaeshadec, you know, the Nerlaesha part. You know, why did they give it that name? The Northern Law Place. Well, it's because it's in the northern part of Nebadon. You know, they're trying to, you know, they don't tell you that anywhere except in the name. In order to know that, you have to look at the name. It says right in the name, it's in the northern part. You know, and it's a law place, because remember, that's the legislative level. So the laws are made in the constellation level. It's the northern law place. You know, and the deck part is added, you know, because of the special Melchizedek colleges that are set up here. But if it wasn't for those special Melchizedek colleges, it'd just be Nerlaesha. the Northern Law Place. See, so that it's this is what they've done, you know, in every case.
The others are IA.
Right, because these are, you know, the IA ones are systems.
Oh.
Right? Remember, in DEC is a constellation.
Right, okay.
Yep. Jeez. See, so just like Satania, see, again, you know, it's Satania, it's you know, it's the nation of adversity, you know, is what that literally means. You know, they're giving it that name because the rebellion occurred in this system, you know. So in that case, see, it's giving an indication of the character of what's going on in the way.
Name it after Satan?
No, it's not named after Satan.
I can't tell you how many people freak out about the name of the
Satan. Right. Yeah. That's because they. That's because
we live in Satania.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, we can't use that to kind of keep them all around.
Again, you've got it. You can't think simplistically. You got to know that the Hebrew word Satan is the word for adversary. You know, you've got to know that. If you don't know that, you're gonna remember everything in the book. Is set up so that you can have as much distortion of meaning as you desire. Just like Jesus said a parable. So if you wanted to go way off on a false tangent, you had all the liberty he could give you. No one is going to force you into the truth. If anything, it's set up so that it's trivial to get error. It's very difficult to get truth. So the Urantia Book is that way. You know, ignorant people will get nothing but error out of it. It's designed that way. It's designed so that they can't get to truth. You know? I mean, they could get facts, but that's part of the problem.
Basic truth about, you know, spiritual truth.
So
be you're a son of God.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe, if you're lucky, you know. You listen to how they rationalize that, and you're going, well, do they actually have a hold of that truth? You know? So.
Comfort's a lot of
it. Yeah, they may have comfort. Okay. So, they may get a spiritual feeling from it, but truth, okay, that's another story. Okay, anyway, so yeah, one of these days I've got to spend a bunch of time, see if I can be scholarly enough to figure out the etymology of those, because it'd be really interesting to know, just like, you know, with Hensalon and Sansalon, and, you know, and Avalon and the local universe names. All right.
Satania itself is composed of over 7,000 astronomical groups, or physical systems, few of which had an origin similar to that of your solar system. The astronomic center of Satania is an enormous dark island of space which, with its attendant spheres, is situated not far from the headquarters of the system government.
So again, like we were talking about, there's all these complex motions. Everything in the local system has some measure of being in orbits about the center of gravity. And this dark island of space is the center of gravity in the system. You know, don't think of everything as, you know, literally going in planet-like orbits in the entire local system. But, you know, there's a motion that has a center of gravity to it. Okay? And that this dark island is that center in our system. This is a fascinating little tidbit. Beyond star systems, there's over 7,000 astronomical groups. So any sort of aggregation of matter, like a big nebula of gas and dust, that'd be one of these. Okay, you know, we'll read in a little bit. There's 2,000 stars, you know, but there's 7,000 astronomical groups. So you got a lot of stuff that isn't stars, but is a gravitational grouping. Okay. So it's a very complex place. It isn't a nice, clean place with just the number of stars that you need for 1,000 inhabited worlds and nothing else. It's just like our solar system, with lots of extraneous stuff like Jupiter and Saturn and whatnot. Okay? There's a lot of stuff that one day when the grand universe is settled in light and life, all that extraneous stuff is somehow going to get incorporated into an eternal fact. Just like Havona doesn't have stray crap floating around in between the billion worlds, okay? Neither will the super universe level. And so there's a huge cleanup project, you know, ahead of us. It'll be amazing to observe, I'm sure, as all this stuff is somehow swept up and eternalized in some mysterious way. All right?
Except for the presence of the assigned power centers, the supervision of the entire physical energy system of Satania is centered on Gerasim. A master physical controller, stationed on this headquarters sphere, works in coordination with the System Power Center, serving as liaison chief of the power inspectors, headquartered on Jerusalem, and functioning throughout the local system.
Okay, so I was just flipping back there. So for those of you that want to, you know where I'm getting it from, that section 4 in paper 29 is where I was reading those 7 different types of master physical controllers from. Okay, this, they referred to this up there, and here it's brought up again, a master physical controller stationed on this headquarters sphere. Okay, that's that category number 1. There's an associate power director that's stationed on Jerusalem. Okay, he's a very personal being, again. Okay, so that fact, you know, it's not just that you've got, you know, mechanical controllers and Frandalangs, you know, to bridge the gap between the Dark Island where the center is and Jerusalem. You know, neither of them are personal. It's not enough to just get the impersonal part represented on Jerusalem when you take off the power center. The personal part is still represented by an associate power director. Okay, so that's the point of that. You know, you want to keep in mind that all of this physics-sounding stuff is great, being regulated by very definitively personal beings. Personal in a way you haven't even imagined being personal yet. You haven't even remotely imagined being as personal as one of these beings is.
They make mistakes?
No, they don't make mistakes. They're perfect. And that's, you know, when you make mistakes, you're not being personal. You're being an animal origin creature. You know, you know, you'll have perfect, you know, when you, yeah, but that's okay. Yeah. Setting aside going on an iniquitous track. I don't think you meant that. I think you just meant, you know, we're ignorant and we make mistakes, right? You know, that's because we haven't fully actualized our personality. Yeah. Remember that, you know, the key to getting into Havona, you know, is finally having that will fully actualized and functioning in its perfection of purpose. You know, there's no mistakes that go into Havona. You know, and there's no mistakes because a full, definitive personality is now being expressed. Okay. All right. Okay, so we've got that associate power director on Jerusalem. So you will get to, you know, you'll get to meet that guy. All right.
The circuitizing and channelizing of energy is supervised by the 500,000 living and intelligent energy manipulators scattered throughout Satania. Through the action of such physical controllers, the supervising power centers are in complete and perfect control of a majority of the basic energies of space, including the emanations of highly heated orbs in the dark energy-charged spheres. This group of living entities can mobilize, transform, transmute, manipulate, and transmit nearly all of the physical energies of organized space.
Remember how there's, you know, 7 of the 10 that are very definitively, and then 2 more, you know, to a degree, you know, manipulatable, and then the 10th, you know, is not directly manipulatable by these beings, as we've read, you know, went through all those details back there. So, you know, up there, in paper 29, they told you that there's these beings called energy transformers, and they said the number of these beings in a super universe is unbelievable. There are almost 1 million in Satania alone. And the usual quota of 100 is 100 for each inhabited world. Okay, those energy transformers, those are the other very personal ones. There's 2 of the 7 that are personal, associate power directors and the energy transformers. Okay, and notice how they said there's almost 1 million in Satania. Well, out of that almost 1 million, you've got 500,000 of them that are in this very much supervisory mode. You know, and then the others, you know, would be doing all kinds of detailed jobs. But you've got this definitive subset of them, 500,000, you know, about half of them, that are this supervisory group. And see, so all of those are very personal, all 500,000 of them, and that one that's on Gerasim, the associate patriarch. So you have 500,001 very personal supervisors, not to mention all of the energy transformers that are not in that supervisory mode in the big, you know, in the whole system level, but maybe down on the planet level, you know, that are very personal. So, you know, like they said there, the 10 that, or 100, the 100, 100 are in each inhabited world. You know, we have 100 of these very personal, incredible beings on this planet.
Okay. That was my question.
The kind of beings, you know, that can just, you know, do energy feats, you know, that are just beyond our imagination. You know, not to mention, you know, the mechanical controllers. Now, if I'm trying to remember, isn't there 10? I think there's 10 mechanical controllers, aren't there, on this planet? If I'm, you know, I can't find it right off the bat. But, you know, these beings, remember, you know, these are beings that can do that job we were talking about, you know, of being able to manipulate the galaxy. Right? So one day, you know, they are going to take a hold of this planet and the sun and everything and micromanage it. There's plenty of power beings to do that here. Okay.
Life has inherent capacity for the mobilization and transmutation of universal energy. You are familiar with the action of vegetable life in transforming the material energy of light into the varied manifestations of the vegetable kingdom. You also know something of the method whereby this vegetative energy can be converted into the phenomena of animal activities, but you know practically nothing of the technique of the power directors and the physical controllers, who are endowed with the ability to mobilize, transform, directionize, and concentrate the manifold energies of space.
Okay, so they're just trying to give you a little analogy there, obviously. You know, up there when they were talking about transform, transmute, you know, what's up with that? What's the difference between transforming and transmuting? And they're trying to give you, you know, it's like think about what you know about plants, you know, and how that then feeds into the animal kingdom, you know, and there's this whole process of
energy exchange.
Yeah, going from different forms of energy expression, and okay, you know, so they just do that kind of thing at the sub-electronic level, you know, with a complexity that's beyond our imagination. And you may recall, you know, with those energy transformers, they had that sentence italicized in there where they said, they can and do change the physical form of the energies of space. They had the whole thing italicized, and we talked about that. It's like, why, and where, you know, why did they do that? Why did they italicize that sentence?
I mean, what do they mean by
that? They mean that, you know, transform and transmute. Remember, you have 10 different forms of energy. They, you know, and the revelators are going, this is like amazing stuff. They can actually go from, you know, modify things from one form to another, you know, whereas the author is thinking, isn't that like impossible? Isn't that like alchemy? Isn't that like turning lead into gold? Okay, and when you say transmute, that's really bringing in alchemy. I mean, that's where that word was originally used. You know, so, but the transform is something even more fundamental than that kind of alchemy sort of a thing. I mean, they can actually alter between these different forms, and then with the forms, they can alter, they can transmute the way those forms work together. Okay, so transform and transmute, you know, sort of like, you know, a lateral to the forms and then parallel with the forms, transmute. That's what they're getting at. They have the ability to just work in all ways with this and do amazing things with this, these raw materials. And that's what they're getting at there. You know, kind of, you know, until you start digging into the physics, it seems kind of a magical to think, you know, that a plant can take sunlight and turn it into leaves, you know. Right, so they're trying to just get you to reflect on that a little bit and think about how magical that seems if you really reflect on it. And that's nothing compared to, they're saying, if you actually could see them do this stuff, you'd be just amazed at how alchemy-like their abilities are. Alchemist-like.
With these being 100 of them on this planet?
Okay, so you have 100 Transformers, and
is there any way to detect their presence by any means? Would you speculate on that?
No, I mean, by and large, no, because they're working sub-electronically. So our sensory abilities and whatnot, you know, consider them to be zero.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
If we could, they wouldn't be telling.
Right. Again, and very important to remember, you know, when you're talking about all this exciting physics in the book, most of it, you know, they use the word energy, thinking, ooh, I know about energy. I could make a free energy device with this knowledge. It's like, no. Anything that you can do considers this stuff to be zero. It's intangible. None of your mass, charge, you know, any sort of, you know, manipulative, detective, you know, none of those things have any recognition of all these energies.
But that's electronic energy. There's another energy we haven't even thought of. That's what it's
talking. Well,
got a question. Perfect control of majority of the basic energies of space. Which ones do you suppose the energies they do not have perfect control over?
Okay, yeah, like I said, they have perfect control over 7 of the 10, and partial control over 2 of the remaining 3. One of those 2 is the literal energy of mechanical mind energy, for instance. Okay, but the 7 are what goes in to make electronic, you know, level energy. So the 7 go into making, you know, the arm of this chair and the body you're made out of. And, you know, I mean, again, you know, we know nothing of that 7. That's all sub-electronic stuff that we don't know anything about. So, you know, so start digging through a chemistry or physics book trying to find the number 7 somewhere. Think you've found those 7 energies. Okay, we don't know anything about that. But, you know, it's what goes into the basic stuff that we know as energy, they have perfect control over it. And so you say, well, why isn't this planet, you know, under perfect control then? Yeah, well, they're going to get to that in a second here. I think we were, where were we?
These beings?
Let's see.
Yes. These beings?
No, these intelligent creatures, wasn't it?
Let's see.
In a way, or no, it is. It's the other one. Yeah, it is these beings. Yes, it is. Okay.
These beings of the energy realms do not directly concern themselves with energy as a component factor of living creatures, not even with the domain of physiological chemistry. They are sometimes concerned with the physical preliminaries of life, with the elaboration of those energy systems which may serve as the physical vehicles for the living energies of elementary material organisms. In a way, the physical controllers are related to the pre-living manifestations of material energy, as the adjutant mind spirits are concerned with the pre-spiritual functions of material mind.
Okay, so just, that's not, you know, we don't want to go into too much detail there, but just, you know, we talked about this before. You know, they're not directly, you notice they very purposely put directly in there in the first sentence. They're not directly, you know, related to living things. But they are indirectly related. And we saw that same thing back in paper 29. There's lots of environmental issues, you know, of an indirect nature that are very important to life that they are involved in, you know, the elaboration of that. When they're talking about how, you know, they are sometimes involved in material organisms in a direct way, like I was saying, those primary associators, you know, literally construct the structure, the material structure that is going to be that prokaryote that the life carriers are going to animate. Okay, so in that way they are, you know, and when the life carriers don't bring the life plasm to a planet, but they do it, when they get there, like they did here, see, you know, then they're going to be involved some. The power beings are going to help the life carriers construct things, right? Okay, so that's what they're, that's the, you know, the sort of the asterisk that they're giving you there, the exception to the general rule, all right?
These intelligent creatures of power control and energy direction must adjust their technique on each sphere in accordance with the physical constitution and architecture of that planet. They unfailingly utilize the calculations and deductions of their respective staffs of physicists and other technical advisors regarding the local influence of highly heated suns and other types of supercharged stars. Even the enormous cold and dark giants of space and the swarming clouds of stardust must be reckoned with. All of these material things are concerned in the practical problems of energy manipulation.
I think that's pretty straightforward. You get the idea there. You know, we've been talking about that. It's a very, very complex problem. You know, to have the right environment for life on this world, they have to take into account all of these complex things. They've got to shield you from all of the vicissitudes of it, for instance. Very, very micromanaged phenomenon.
The power energy supervision of the evolutionary inhabited worlds is the responsibility of the master physical controllers. But these beings are not responsible for all energy misbehavior on Urantia. There are a number of reasons for such disturbances, some of which are beyond the domain and control of the physical custodians. Urantia is in the lines of tremendous energies, a small planet in the circuit of enormous masses, and the local controllers sometimes employ enormous numbers of their order in an effort to equalize these lines of energy. They do fairly well with regard to the physical circuits of Satania, but have trouble insulating against the powerful Nerlachadek currents.
Okay, and I don't think I mentioned it yet. I went back and did find it. There is 10 mechanical controllers on the planet. And so even with 10, you know, just unbelievably powerful beings on our world and those mechanical controllers, beings, I use the word loosely, you know, they're not really personal, but entities, you've got vicissitudes like they're pointing out here. You know, why? Well, the one they're pointing out, you can expect some issues in a very unsettled domain like we live in, you know, in this part of the Milky Way galaxy. Things are pretty wild, wild west still in this part of the Milky Way galaxy. And so even with lots and lots of beings, and very powerful beings at that, you know, there's, it's like, okay, guys, the ride's going to get a little bumpy here. You know, strap on your seatbelts. We can't do anything about it. But besides that, you know, there are a number of reasons, they said, not just that. I mean, one basic one is, it's not the fifth stage of light and life on this world yet. If it was the fifth stage of light and life, there would be perfect control of every automaton on this planet. But it's an evolutionary phenomenon. Even though they are master physical controllers, they have no innate limitation, they're not allowed to micromanage things ahead of the evolutionary process. Once we've reached that stage as a world, the fifth stage of light and life, they will take a hold of it, you know, and there will cease to be one automaton out of place anywhere from the surface of the earth, you know, anywhere from the top of the atmosphere to the center of the earth. Everything will be perfectly in place, and eternally so. But before that, there's an evolutionary process, and we have to go with the flow of that evolutionary process. They don't get in the way of that. So, you know, that's, you know, good things happen to, or bad things happen to good people, you know, quote unquote, just because it's an evolutionary process. Yeah, that's the domain we live in.
Are these the same beings that Jesus used at the healing?
Right. The master physical controllers were you know involved in all sorts of. I mean, you have the life carriers, the midwayers, master physical controllers. I mean, all of these various beings. Yeah. I mean, anything that involved, you know, very direct. You know, like to turn water into wine. I mean, the master physical controllers. You know, did that. You know, they just grab a hold of the molecules and arrange them into aged wine. Right. And again, see, it's like, well, I always pictured Jesus having a magic wand and he made the molecules move. No, we just read, you know, that whole bit about moving the molecules of the local universe around, that's not his job. That's the power being's job. And most of it's done before he even gets here. That's pre-creative stuff, not creative stuff. So, you know, in general, he doesn't do things directly. You know, he orders it to be done. So you have to allow a lot of intermediaries that, you know, humans haven't had before between God the Father and where the rubber meets the road and between Jesus of Nazareth and where the rubber meets the road. There is vast numbers. You know, when he, oops, I shouldn't have thought that. You know, when he had things like that, I mean, you know, they tell you there was a large number of beings. I mean, there's probably millions of beings, you know, just, if you could have seen that, you know, what was going on, just this froth of beings scurrying about doing all this stuff, okay? Not to mention a power being that sort of just is present in the whole place and kind of, you know, everything is within his body, you know, and he just manipulates the kaleidoscopic nature of his body and it manipulates all the atoms in the, you know, that he's, you know, that are within his presence. Right, so it was, you know, it would be really amazing to actually watch those things happen when he orders them to do something. All right, you know, it would be a lot more exciting than if it was a magical phenomenon where there wouldn't be anything to see, you know. A real phenomenon will be very exciting to see, you know. All right, so that's, you know, even though we had to kind of push a little bit past there, that's the place. We're going to shift gears then next time, and we're going to actually get into some astronomy. Yeah, we have to really kind of think in detail about what we know as astronomers. So any knowledge you have will help, and I'll try to fill in some of the gaps. You know, and we'll do some astronomy in this paper, and then we'll get into some physics in the next paper. All right, let's take a moment here now.